Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Social Media and Politics Podcast, bringing you expert insights into how social media is changing the political game. I'm your host, Michael Pesetta, political scientist at Loon University. Remember, you can follow the show on Twitter at SMNP Podcast or visit us on the web at socialmediaandpolitics.org. All right, y'all, thanks so much for tuning in. In this episode, I'm going to be speaking with Ned Howie. He is the CEO of Tectonica, which is a digital organizing firm that builds solutions to engage and mobilize supporters of progressive candidates and causes. And Tectonica is based in Barcelona. They do a lot of work with candidates and causes in the European Union, but they've also worked with candidates in the US and causes in Africa. So really an international firm. And I wanted to focus particularly on their work in Europe because they've built websites for Emmanuel Macron's La République en Marche in the 2017 French presidential and legislative elections. They've worked with Sadiq Khan, the mayor in London. They've worked with Norwegian and Belgian Green parties. So that kind of breadth of expertise within the European Union, I thought would be interesting to dive into and kind of contextualize it with what's different in the US, for example. So you can check out their full portfolio of work at their website, tectonica.co. I'll link to that in the show notes. But in this episode, we'll dive into how some of the solutions that Tectonica builds plugs into Nation Builder. We'll talk about some differences between maybe big data approaches and those that really seek to engage a small niche audience of supporters. We'll talk a little bit about differences between front-end and back-end digital product design, and also differences in hardware between desktop computers and mobile devices. So I was really excited to talk to Ned to hear more about campaigning and organizing in a European context, particularly, you know, with GDPR and the kind of data privacy and voter file restrictions that aren't applicable to the same extent in the US. And I think it's interesting to get the perspectives on that from someone who's working with it on a daily basis. So without further ado, let me turn it over to Ned Howie. He is the CEO of Tectonica. Ned, thanks for taking the time out and welcome to the Social Media and Politics Podcast.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much for having me. Excited to be here.
So can you start out by giving us a brief introduction to Tectonica and the type of services it offers to campaigns and causes?
Yeah, absolutely. Tectonica is a full service agency that, in terms of describing what we say we do the art of digital organizing. And the way to best kind of describe what that is, because it's many things, and we work with different clients in different ways, but we really help folks transform their impact in the world and achieve their missions better, win elections more, reach more people, and have more change. Basically, through using digital organizing methodology, technology, and creative. So, you know, a lot of people come across digital organizing and think of it as like a department or a position. We think of it more of a way of operating, but we know that to really get fully on board with that, a lot of organizations or campaigns need a little helping hand. And so we have a full range of experts here that can help with every part of that, from the strategy to the building of things, to the creative components, as well as supporting people as they're running things or, you know, running for election.
Right. And I was browsing Tectonica's portfolio online, and a lot of your work seemed to be centered around designing websites and solutions that effectively plug into Nation Builder. So before we get into some more specific details, can you outline what Nation Builder is and how websites feed into that ecosystem?
Yeah, absolutely. And while we do work on a number of systems, Nation Builder is one of the ones that we do the most work on. And we really love the system, particularly for international work. You know, our work is all progressive based. Nation Builder is not a partisan software, but ours is very specifically progressive based. But we really love Nation Builder specifically because it's kind of an all-in-one toolkit. And what we find is really essential for folks that are trying to get on board with really doing digital organizing, with really building relationships, with scaling, with approaching their supporters in a different way, you need to use a number of different techniques. There's no one silver bullet. And so Nation Builder is a wonderful system to kind of make that transition and that move because it has all of the essential elements that you might need kind of built into one system. That doesn't mean that there's aren't other things that you might plug in as well that aren't kind of those core essentials, but it has all those core essentials there. And so it's a really good system for doing that. It is both a CMS, which is the part that controls your website, and a CRM, which is the part that kind of knowing who your people are. It's a database of information of the supporters and the people that you're talking to, as well as a communication center. So, you know, it has an email system, it has tie-in with social networks and other such things that basically help you coordinate the entirety of digital organizing activities.
And so it seems to me like a kind of general, you know, hub for all these different platforms and data to kind of hook into. But is there a difference between how Nation Builder works with websites or social networks or newsletters, as you're saying? Are some more valuable than others, particularly for what Nation Builder is kind of built to do?
The main thing that I'd say is really different of Nation Builder from the other systems is that the CMS component is directly and immediately and quite deeply integrated with the CRM component. So your website actually is impacted and affected by the exact same backend as your database of people. And so when somebody signs up on the website, you know, on a page, if you set up an action page or something like that, it will immediately impact the information that you have about that person. Conversely, you can also impact the way that somebody sees a page or the experience that they have on the website, depending upon if they are signed in as a certain person. So if there's, you know, things that I've expressed as interest, for example, I could see one view versus another. And that level of integration, you know, the real power of a system like Nation Builder comes from the high level of integration, because we want to have our organizations and campaigns working with their supporters and their general populations in a way that is really holistic, that is really, you know, treating the people as people, basically. We don't do big data, we do smart data. And that's very much about knowing and engaging consensually with people that you're working with, and really treating them as you would people that you know in your real world and real life, and hopefully you do know in the real world and real life.
Gotcha. So that would mean that if you're either signaling to the system or the system predicts that you're most interested in climate change, when you visit a website for a candidate or a cause, it might give you a climate change message versus another progressive issue.
That is one way that you can configure it. Yep. Absolutely.
Okay, cool.
And that's the kind of work that we do too, is we kind of work with the system to based upon the particular strategy and the context of the situation, what's needed. And it might not be issue-based, it might be location-based, or it might be that we need to do certain things strategically to build a certain area or get a supporters involved in a certain way for success of the campaign. We'll work with kind of setting up the system for that interface with the public and with its supporters as well.
Gotcha. So I'm curious to hear more about how websites can sort of plug into that, and strictly from a back-end functional perspective. So not taking into account the color schemes or the UX design, what are some of the key components a political website should have, and how has that changed over time?
Yeah, that's a great question. And a lot of people are still, in my opinion at least, doing this the wrong way. Basically, our way of doing politics has not changed as much as it really needs to meet the time. We live in this world where people are getting their information in a very different way, you know, because of the advent of social media, because of this kind of higher level of customization in the experience of getting information that people experience every day. People's expectations and the way in which they interact with information has changed dramatically. Part of that is people are used to getting information through their peers, and as well, people, the kind of like sources or voices of information has become much more decentralized. And so what that's really led to is a number of things. Number one is people start from a place of distrust, especially from authoritarian voices that are just one way shouting at them. So if you're your traditional newspaper that would work in the 1980s or the 1880s or whenever is not going to hold the same value in terms of the way people are hearing the information. The same being obviously a kind of establishment political party or candidate. People really don't start from a place of trust with those entities as they did, which is part of the reason we're seeing kind of a decline in the trust of those established political parties. People are kind of going against a lot of those established parties and politicians. The one thing that people constantly say that they're voting for is the candidates that they feel are authentic or real. And that's a reflection of the fact that we've changed the way in which we process information as a society. And so, you know, we can do websites that match. The one way that it could be done that I think is very ineffective is to just do websites like people used to do newspapers. Just have have one-way communication, have the voice, the authority of the, you know, the political party or the organization spouting what it thinks about the world. But we find that to be really ineffective in these days. And we find that that has a diminishing returns at this point because people don't want to just be blared messages at them. That's not the way they're interacting with the rest of the information in their world. And so the websites that we make and work on are very different. Our websites are just one component of the work that we do in kind of transforming organizations and campaigns to do digital organizing, but they're a very central part. It's still one of the major ways that online people actively go and engage with, you know, especially themselves. They have the agency usually when they're going to a website. They're making that choice at that moment. They're not being reached out to. So it's one of the ways where they're stepping up and saying, I want to be engaged. And so it's a very key moment, a very key place to present to those users that are coming there information as well as opportunities. And that's where really the work that we do is quite different. We see a lot of still like political party sites that are, you know, their blog role and their newsfeed or whatever, kind of the first things that are up there. Really, what we try to work with people to do is to look at the engagement opportunities that folks can have as they're going to the website. If they're going to the website, it's usually they've been brought there by something that's shared or they're interested themselves. And it's a real opportunity to not just, you know, bang people over the head with information, but to create opportunities for engagement. That's the point where a real shift in the dynamic occurs. And this is our bigger mission as an organization. We believe that the politics, good politics will follow, basically, and quite honestly, progressive politics. If people feel that they're being asked to engage as supporters, that means opportunities to have their voice heard. That means opportunities for them to engage and support, and where they can see themselves as part of the entity and organization. So again, shifting from that one-way microphone to something that they have a seat at the table, they have a voice, and they're part of the ownership of that thing itself.
Yeah, it's interesting what you're saying about one-way communication. We did an episode recently with political voiceover artists, and they were saying that both in the commercial industry and in the political space, that exactly that type of shift has happened, where you just want to kind of do a voiceover or a commercial where you lower the mic over a conversation that might be happening in a coffee house,
right?
Not a sort of broadcasted by this car, by this candidate.
That's right. People don't trust that anymore.
Right.
And with good reason. People are clever enough that we know what's behind that. You know, if people see themselves in a movement, if people see themselves having a place within the decision process and the support for building a organization or a campaign, they're going to trust that campaign as well. They should.
Yeah. So that leads into my next question. And I know you've done work with candidates both in the U.S. and in Europe, but I'd like to ask about Europe because national parties there have a pretty definitive brand identities, color schemes, and logos. And so when you're designing a website or products with the ultimate goal of organizing supporters, what factors go into front-end design in a way that kind of resonates with that identity or brand of the party?
Yeah, absolutely. One of my two business partners is our chief creative officer, and she is just a brilliant, brilliant designer that just eats, sleeps, and breathes design. Brand is one part of that, and brand is certainly really important because there's two things that are important with brand. One is understanding the audience and their tastes, what they like. But you could be speaking to the same audience from totally different organizations and with totally different brands. So it's not just about, you know, thinking through who you're speaking to, because that's a key part to, as we said, bring them to the table or have their voices heard. But you also want to think about the tone in which you're relaying to them. And so the flip side of that audience factor is the tone. And so you want to still represent yourself, represent your organization appropriately for the work that it's doing, as well as really represent the political party and its values if it's a party or, you know, an organization. So if you're, you know, if you're not representing diversity in your tone or in the design, and that's core value of the organization that you're doing, then you're going to be missing a lot, even if your audience likes the design. But really for us, it's not just about brand. I think this is really important, which is, you know, we make pretty websites, but we only make pretty websites because it's part of a bigger picture. They need to be functional and they need to be appropriate. And so our goal is not to make a pretty website on website launch day. Our goal is to really have people engaging and meeting those benchmarks or goals for the organizations for growth. So that means ensuring that the design is not just good looking and has a great brand, but is really functioning to engage people. And we do that through really kind of looking at what are the most important things to be done. How do we make it clear to the supporters what their place is in that and how they can be a part of it? Making that clear, as a message and as a narrative that we're communicating to them, and then really giving them those opportunities which they can step forward and engage.
Mm. And what function does that engagement have for the party or campaign? And I'm thinking, if you have an engaging website where you can click a bunch of stuff, you can, interact with a bunch of different features on the site, I'm supposing that provides more data points for the campaign. Is that, I understand from the visitor's side, they have more opportunities for expression, but are those opportunities for expression through the website valuable for the campaign as well?
Yeah, and that kind of gets to where we've seen you can definitely have a highly engaging campaign that fails miserably, or an organization that has a lot of engagement points and doesn't do well. And that's where really the strategy comes in. You want to, of course, really focus both on making sure that you have those engagement points and also making sure that they are strategically functional to achieve your goals. And so, we talk about kind of people power as a kind of resource, just like money. And sometimes people power can lead to money because people donate. Sometimes it can lead to them taking a political stand or contacting a legislator or voting. There's all kinds of ways that people can impact the work of the organizations and campaigns that we work with. But the really key thing here, of course, just like a very well-funded campaign won't necessarily be the one to win. They have to think strategically about how to use that money in an effective way. So too must we think through people power and how to apply it strategically. And so certain strategies or certain engagement methods are going to be prioritized, obviously, from the get-go. And that means a number of things. One, you're going to plan really well for it. But also you're going to adjust that as you go along because maybe the information that you had or the situation changes dramatically. We're, of course, living in a year where everything's changed dramatically, it seems. They're not letting us off the hook this year. But, I think it's a really good example, too, of how we have to have strategy that is nimble and where we can change things to be able to advance the overall objectives and goals and mission of the different efforts that we're working with.
Right. And how does that, both in terms of, function and design, how does it work across parties and individual candidates? So I'm thinking specifically of your work with the French party En Marche for the 2017 presidential and legislative elections, where Emmanuel Macron essentially crowdsourced his candidates for that election. And Tectonica built a central template for the party, but it could be customized by the various candidates individually. So how do you strike that balance between collective party and individual candidate identity?
Yeah, and that's definitely one of the things that we come across a lot, because you do want people understanding kind of the larger level. Sometimes it's a national level, sometimes it's a global level, and the organization that's behind that or the movement that's behind that. Sometimes they're not affiliated with specific organizations. And also, really, a lot of this change should and does come from the local level. Macron, I don't think, is the best example of kind of changing strategy along the way, because that was basically a 8-week run from when the first candidate was officially announced to when the elections were, somewhere around 8 weeks. Of course, they finished with 60% of the French National Assembly, over 60%. So he did something very innovative in the approach there. Of course, as you mentioned, kind of like took a broader range of candidates applying and selected them. But the thing that's really kind of important in that too is that there were really clear guidelines set for it. There were some new things that were put in, and some of those values were really put deeply into the selection process. One of those things, of course, was 50% of the candidates had to be women, 50% of the candidates had to be people that were not involved in politics previously. And that kind of ties back to this also trying to re-earn trust away from kind of this generalized distrust of political authority or kind of established political authority. In terms of that campaign itself, as you mentioned, we did kind of a template that could be used by the local campaigns themselves. And one of the things that was most important for that strategy was that they needed to be rolled out on an individual level pretty easily. They needed to be set up so that administrators and people running these campaigns locally could really set up the key things that they needed to do in order to kind of advance their campaign. And a lot of these folks, as we mentioned, are not folks that have been involved in politics before. So there needed to be kind of a guiding structure for that. If anything, I'd say in that campaign, the brilliance or in the work that we did was not what we let people do, but what we didn't let people do. Oftentimes in campaigns, people kind of go after the flashy things or the more exciting new things that they've heard of. But really what we find often is that these core best practices, these core things that people are doing, you know, we don't want to abandon those in light of the innovation. There's still room for innovation, but we also, the real innovation can come sometimes from using these standard things that we have, email and, you know, online engagement and whatever they are, in ways that are themselves maybe new, but using the same techniques that we know will, of course, work.
Gotcha. So there's an element of fundamentals, but you can innovate to some extent within those fundamentals.
Absolutely. And in this case, you know, I think the innovation was coming, obviously, Macron was leaning heavily on digital organizing. And specifically, you know, I think if we looked back 10 years, I don't think you could come up with a party, you know, as Macron did in that short of a time. He had no party previously. You know, we're used to 10 years ago, you'd have to spend years, if not decades, building infrastructure, making press connections, et cetera, et cetera. And now we have this opportunity to engage people much more directly and use the tools that we have to develop those relationships, to give people engagement, to put people power to work for actually campaigning. And so, you know, we like to say, I want to be really clear, there's no magic sauce. You can't spray glitter and, you know, so any one technology and suddenly you win. It takes hard work. That's one of our values as a company, is that we believe that changing the world takes hard work. And the reason it takes hard work is because real change is made through the relationships between people. What the technology lets you do that you wouldn't be able to do otherwise is to be able to scale those relationships. And so you can have a system where you roll it out to 400 campaigns or more than 400 campaigns, I believe, in France, you know, in a party that didn't previously exist a few weeks before, and set those people up for running a national level election.
Gotcha. And what about national differences within Europe? So I'm thinking you've worked with green parties in both Belgium and Norway, for example, and they're obviously similar in their political agendas, but they're coming from different cultural contexts. So does that have any bearing on crafting a platform for digital organizing?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I think one of the things too, there's a lot of agencies out there that kind of learn a certain model and then repeat. That's not been our model, because we find that no context is the same. I mean, even, you know, like we've worked with, for example, two health organizations that were fighting for health rights of Latino populations in San Francisco's Bay Area and providing services as well. And the websites that we did for them were entirely different. We were talking same community, same types of organizations, and their specific needs that they had strategically were very different. And so our model as a company has always been to look at each context very specifically, understand that, look at the challenges, and to draft a strategy that's going to be very specific. The work that we do, it's probably from our, as a business model, it's probably not the best one, because it takes a little bit deeper rolling up our sleeves and getting in there deeper and looking and thinking through what's going to best work. It's a lot more interesting for us, certainly, and we find it's a lot more effective than just taking, you know, oh, this worked here, this worked there. You don't want to look at what worked in different scenarios and generally what's working across in terms of methodology. You really had to apply specifically to each context. And that we really look towards our communities that we work with. We look towards our clients, their organizations, their supporters, for the information of what's actually going to work within those situations. It's hard for them sometimes. It's like they themselves are bogged in the day-to-day work, so it's hard for them to kind of reflect back on what that thing is. It's like when I look at myself in the mirror in the morning, I definitely do not see the same view that my boyfriend sees or that, you know, my coworkers see. I'm thinking, oh, what about that blemish on there, whatever. You know, it's really hard to see yourself. And so for a lot of our clients, it's the same situation. It's very hard for them to identify where they need to grow or change. And it's very helpful to have folks come in from the outside and kind of look at the full context and help them see those things. But the answer is always there. The solutions are always within the community itself, from the organization, and based in what their knowledge is. What we do is we hold up a big mirror and kind of help them see that it's there, and help them plan how to utilize those strengths and those things in order to succeed.
And is that working directly with just the organization, or are you kind of bringing in, you know, focus groups or beta testing certain things to see what the community is sort of responding to?
Yeah, it's very dependent. And so sometimes we don't do polling ourselves here. We love our clients that do have the resources to do polling. It's in many contexts, it's very important to have that data to be able to understand, you know, understand the audience, understand the supporters, understand the different motivations. So I love the situations when we're able to work with folks to kind of look at that further set of information. That said, we've also done cases where we don't do polling, we'll always kind of really plunge the, you know, access that we have to the staff itself. And we'll often find that the staff anecdotal knowledge or knowledge from supporters, individual supporters that get the chance to talk to them, that they have a very good idea to start with. And so it's not that polling or, you know, large data processing kind of surveying everything is great. But a lot of the times we find it's just as good to actually go through the process of asking the people that know these communities and work with these communities day in, day out. For us, it's, you know, the important thing is being able to think about that information in a way that's going to determine a logic model from where they want to be, where they are at the current moments, and how they're going to get between those two points.
Because I'm sure one of the aspects of, you know, audience research is whether people are primarily using, you know, desktops or mobile devices in different contexts, different communities. And I'm curious about that difference. So how does Tectonica approach these kind of hardware differences between PCs and mobile devices? And do they factor into how you design your websites or products?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's more than just a difference in screen size too. The way that people interact with something on mobile and the way that somebody interacts with something on web is going to be quite different. In addition to the fact that we have to, you know, we're here in Spain, we've got great connection for the most part, but a lot of our clients are working in areas where they don't have great connections. And so we've worked in the Middle East, we've worked in Africa, you know, we've worked in places where that contextual information is really important to know, because we don't want to, you know, we can test something on a mobile here and, wow, it's got all these crazy functionalities and it works great on my phone, but we have to understand that we're not the people that are going to use this. And so we will make some strategic decisions sometimes, yes, to kind of favor simplicity or favor lighter loading and higher, you know, quicker functionality over something that's going to be much more highly complex on a phone and take a lot longer to load, especially in situations where they might not have the same connection out on the street. And we also know a lot of our communities actually, honestly, are much more on the phone than they are on desktop. And so we have to think that through and what that works with, how that works. We've even done, one of the things that we've done is we created a product that's actually built front end of Nation Builder. It's a hybrid app, so you can, you know, organizations can kind of go in. Organizations can go in, or political parties, we've had political parties as well, kind of put that to the app stores through Android and through iPhone. And that's a whole entirely web app experience. The structure of that is entirely different. The engagement is entirely different. You go to that as you would any other app, sign in, and you get a personalized experience within it. Technically speaking, it's the, you know, more or less the front end website, but we impact everything that happens on that based upon what happens with the user in the back end. And that's one of the advantages of a system like Nation Builder that's highly integrated. You can do some pretty fancy stuff on it.
Gotcha. Now, I'd like to ask you about, because you've worked with both clients in the US and the EU, what are some of the key differences in organizing between those two contexts? I mean, what are the key differences that impact your work directly?
Yeah, you know, being from the US, I get the question a lot, and we do a lot of work in Europe. There's a lot of different major contextual things that are very different, of course. One of the things I love about doing work in Europe is that we, you know, most of these countries, or pretty much every country, actually has multi-party systems, which makes a very different dynamic and kind of a strategic approach. One of the other major differences is that we won't necessarily have a voter file, which, of course, in the US, there's this kind of base data set voter file. And of course, GDPR is a major difference as well. And so a lot of people kind of, especially US consultants, look at GDPR, they just start to shake, you know. But I actually think all in all, in some ways, it's been a really good thing. You know, our work is transforming the way that people work, especially away from things that are flashy, big data, whatever tech things that are being sold that mostly are out there for a profit model, and going away from the real organizing part of it, which is, in a sense, has the same basis as what we used to do throughout a long, long time, where we go and knock on doors and meet our neighbors and talk to them and build those relationships. That should be the basis of the work that we're doing online, regardless of if we're using websites, email, social media, WhatsApp, databases, whatever it is, that core should still be about the relationships. And so in a sense, GDPR has been a helper for that because it pushes a lot of folks to consider your audience, consider who they are, how they want to be communicated, you know, have a consensual communication relationship with them, that you're not sending them messages that they don't want. And, you know, in the US, there's a lot of kind of data buying or list swaps or all kinds of techniques to kind of grow your list really quickly. And I find those to really be very misleading sometimes too, in terms of actual effectiveness. I would much have a much smaller list with more people opening and reading emails than an enormous list where people don't know who you are, don't care what you do, and are more than anything being annoyed. So it doesn't mean that GDPR doesn't have components that are tricky and challenging, or that we lose some of the opportunities. But it's helped guide, I think, European politics, and I think we'll be seeing more and more of this in a direction which I think is the correct direction.
So kind of just thinking out loud here, if in the US you have this large collection of data, and that I'm assuming on the one hand that makes campaigning more competitive because everyone's sort of list swapping, buying data from all these, you know, big data warehouses, what have you. So on the one hand, that would make it more competitive. But on the other hand, in Europe, you have multi-party systems and you have an environment where access to data is more restricted. So that might make the campaigning more competitive because it's maybe going in the dark a bit more with less data. So which environment would you say is more competitive when it comes to campaigning at the sort of strategic level?
Both. I'm going to cheat on the answer to this. They're competitive in very different ways. But the real competition that we're facing right now is not, you know, party against party, you know, and who can buy bigger lists and who can grow more. But really, the real competition that we have is being able to figure out a way that we can communicate with people and engage them, more than anything, engage them in these times when our general mode of operation between us is not leading people to do that. Social media today and the way that people communicate between each other online, for the most part, is leading people to become less engaged, question their assumptions less, and quite frankly, to very easily believe things that are not true. And so we have a lot of things, you know, the real competition, for example, I don't think is between parties, but against, you know, with the clients that we work with that are generally very value-based clients, fighting things like racist, anti-immigrant sentiments, you know, basically those that are willing to use fakes and fear-based approaches that work very well in our times, honestly. And I think that that is something that we're seeing both in the US and in Europe equally. You know, which one's more competitive or which one's going to move faster? I actually see really big innovations and improvements on both of those places. And I think this is a real time right now of change, especially with just major social changes due to the current crisis of COVID. I think we see things like the Black Lives Matter movement, where this is also an opportunity for us to really make some significant changes. It's happening enormously in the US, and I can assure you that it will be happening in Europe, hopefully for good, not for bad, within the next year.
Yeah, it'd be definitely interesting to watch. But I want to pick up on the coronavirus situation and the state of organizing in a scenario of extended social distancing. I saw on Tectonica's blog that testing and experimentation during these times were stressed.
Yeah.
There's also a bit of excitement about emerging platforms like House Party, I think you wrote about. So what?
Kind of threw that one out there because it's fun.
Yeah, exactly. So I'd like to hear more about that and what tips you would have for campaigners listening.
Yeah, I mean, and here's the thing, you know, there are many clues to what's going to work and even more clues for what's not going to work in this current context. But it's really important to understand we have never seen a context like this before, where you have the technologies that we have today and where we have a global pandemic going on and issues like social distancing or, you know, whatever else that we're kind of dealing with as a result of the COVID-19 pandemic. And we need to be a little bit humble, but also a little brave, because we need to make mistakes and we need to learn from those mistakes. We definitely want to look at best practices, but we need to be innovative about what we try in this situation, which really is important why we come back to testing. It's why we come back to checking what's working, why we keep our eyes on those benchmarks and those KPIs and, you know, make sure that whatever we're trying, we're seeing if it's actually working in the moment, because it's really a moment of learning for us. At the same time, what we do know is that it's an opportunity for digital to have even more of a place than it previously had. I mean, my dad, I got this really cute text from him where he's like, I'm using this thing called Zoom. Have you heard of it? And I'm like, yeah, I spend like 6 hours a day having client meetings with people all over the world on Zoom, you know, like probably for the last, you know, 5 years at least, maybe 4 years. But my dad, who's in his 70s, you know, he's now a Zoom user. And we're seeing folks in older populations that were not as digitally oriented and not as online, kind of having to move to get that human connection. The holdouts basically are moving to online methods. And so that's also a real opportunity for us to lean on what works with digital organizing, avoid the things that we know don't work on digital organizing, like all the tricks and BS and smoke that's being sold, and you know, really make sure that we're using these technologies to build relationships. We're working with in the Netherlands with the FNV, which is basically like the largest union in the Netherlands. It's like the AFL-CIO in the US. It's kind of a large affiliation of unions, and basically, we're working with their campaign to raise the minimum wage in the Netherlands. And they had a whole set of field organizers that were out in the communities doing the work they should be, connecting with people with those relationships. And COVID popped up, you know, and suddenly, you know, like 20 of their field organizers, something like that, is a large number of field organizers. You know, they went from one digital organizer and 20 field organizers to a team of people that couldn't leave their house and needed to do organizing from their home, which meant they had basically effectively 21 digital organizers from one day to the next. And so it's really great, though, because I'd rather, you know, we worked with and trained and have, we're still developing methods for them to really do their work effectively. And I would say I would rather take a group of field organizers that understand relationships, that understand communities, that understand connecting with people, and introduce them to digital organizing, because they can do it. I do believe in them for using this. And they are not going to forget, we would hope, the importance of those relationships, no matter what medium they're using, you know, so they're going to be using email and social media and whatever other means of communication, WhatsApp and whatnot, in a way that will respect people, that will engage those communities in terms of real relationships.
Yeah, it goes back to what you're saying about the idea that, you know, there's these certain fundamentals that there's room for innovation within, but the fundamentals kind of stay the same.
That's absolutely right. And if anything, you know, we're trying to show folks how to use those core technologies in the right ways. So, you know, it's really easy to go out and buy the new flashy smart TV that has the remote control with all the buttons that we probably won't use. But, you know, you got to adjust your antenna so you get the right connection. Or this is a terrible metaphor I just wandered into. But
you got to change the channel somehow.
You got to change. Yeah, maybe you need to focus on what channel you're watching, or, you know, how good the movie is, or whatnot. People are so often focused on things, you know, I'll give you a really good example. People are really focused on what type of A/B testing they can do for email, or what subject line is going to get people to open up an email. And especially in the US, we get a lot of folks that are like, there's this huge discussion about what is the thing that's basically going to trick people into opening that message. And I'm like, I really don't care about that conversation. The conversation I care about is figuring out how you're going to segment and send that email to a list of people that actually care about that email, because you know who they are, because you've engaged them in a way that's respectful and honest and true, and make it, you know, that they know who you are in terms of an organization, so they're not getting some random email out of the blue. That's going to be an effective method, not just trying to trick with, you know, whatever catchy open line for a subject.
Well, Ned, this has been super interesting and also refreshing to hear about some insights on the European side of campaigning and organizing. So thanks so much for taking the time out and coming on the podcast.
It's been an absolute pleasure, and thank you.
I've just been speaking with Ned Howie, CEO of Tectonica. You can visit their website at tectonica.co. And that's a wrap for this episode of the Social Media and Politics Podcast. Thank you so much for tuning in. I'm not entirely sure yet what the next episode will be. I've got a couple things in the works and chasing people down during the summer and a pandemic. But keep your eye on those podcast feeds and subscribe if you haven't already, and you'll get the next episode when it drops. I'm your host, Michael Becetta, signing off from Malmö. See you next time.